Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Monday morning. It's August 10th. 67 degrees currently in Old Town Park City under mostly sunny skies. We've got 64 degrees in the Heber Valley. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Monday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch back on this Monday. We're looking at partly cloudy skies. We will see a chance of a couple of isolated showers and thunderstorms developing this afternoon with the peak daytime heating. High temperatures will climb into the mid to upper 80s for us here in Park City. The Heber Valley, we're looking at high temperatures climbing into the lower 90s for highs as we go throughout this afternoon. Again, keep an eye to the sky for any of those pop-up storms. They primarily will produce lightning and gusty winds, but there is the chance of seeing some heavy downpours as well. As we make our way into your Tuesday, a very similar forecast. We'll call it partly cloudy skies. Temperatures climbing into the mid 80s for highs in Park City. We'll see those highs in the low 90s in the Heber Valley, and we'll have a chance of an isolated storm or two. As we move into your Wednesday, I think we start to tick up the chance of pop-up showers and storms across the Wasatch Back. High temperatures will only be around 80 degrees in Park City, so definitely on the cooler side, with highs only in the mid-80s in the Heber Valley. Again, a decent chance of those afternoon showers and storms developing across the area. I think we see a better chance of showers and storms as we get towards your Thursday. In fact, showers and thunderstorms will be likely as we get into your Thursday across portions of the Wasatch Back. That's going to really help to keep those temperatures down. How about high temperatures only in the mid-70s for us in Park City? We'll see those high temperatures only around 80 degrees in the Heber Valley. As we make our way into your Friday, a very similar forecast, a good chance of showers and thunderstorms across the area. That means high temperatures only into the low to mid-70s in Park City, with highs in the upper 70s to near 80 in the Heber Valley. We'll start to lower those rain chances to back to your typical isolated pop-up storms as we head towards your Saturday into Sunday. And along with that, though, we'll still keep those temperatures somewhat cool, mid to upper 70s for Park City for highs, and we'll see those high temperatures in the lower 80s in the Heber Valley. That's the latest on your forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
And again, you can stay tuned to KPCW or check our social media for updates on the Rocky Canyon fire. What we know at this point, haven't heard about a morning briefing at this point, but we do know that there had been an evacuation order for the Summit County line at Hogbat Summit to West Hennifer Road, both sides of the road. Hennifer residents west of 300 West and both sides of South Hennifer Road. That is in Summit County. Also, an evacuation warning telling people to, you know what, be ready, east of 300 West and Hennifer to I-84. And then again, to be ready also in Franklin Canyon to Icy Spring, Wohale. Last we've heard is that about 13,000 acres have burned there in the land, basically between I-84 and I-80 near East Canyon Park. Well, stay tuned. Coming up this morning on the local news hour, I'll be checking in with Summit County Health Department Director Phil Bondurant. Later on, from Mountain Mediation Center, Associate Director Ned Droist with details on the center's family and divorce services. And finally, from Park City Public Works, I have Utilities Director Clint McAfee, along with Water Quality Manager Michelle DeHaan, with an update on Park City's water supplies given the dry winter and hot summer. Taking a look now at some local news, Basin Recreation will downsize its proposal for new field houses and the bonds to pay for them. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports some taxpayers say their annual tax bill is high enough.
The Summit County Council is weighing whether to put a $150 million bond question on the November ballot for Basin Recreation. Some taxpayers are in favor of putting it to a vote, but as the August 20th deadline for that decision nears, council members and recreation district leaders alike say they've also heard concerns. The bonds would pay for two new field houses and be paid back with property taxes. Once the district finalized the cost, Basin Rec Board Chair Ryan Bruce says he and the rest of the board expected public opinion to shift. Orly Bush was one of the two people who spoke at a Wednesday public hearing about the bonds. Both thought the amount was too high.
I think, like many people, I feel like I'm being taxed out of my home. My present tax bill to Basin Rec, with Basin Rec bonds A and B, is over $720, which is more than 10% of my total tax bill. If this goes in, it's going to add another $500 plus my $600 membership at Basin Rec. Is it the community's responsibility to provide this level of health club?
To respond to those concerns, Bruce says Basin Rec is taking a step back and will likely propose a smaller bond.
I and our committee are open to a lower amount, but that would decrease facilities to one.
Of the two possible field houses, one in Jeremy Ranch would have rock climbing and the other in Silver Creek Village would have a larger pool. Both would include other sports and fitness facilities like the Kimball Junction Fieldhouse does. District Director Robert Parrish says Basin Rec's repeated polling shows residents are split over taking on so much debt. Surveys also indicate that an aquatics facility is a bigger priority than indoor climbing.
A lot of people that, you know, even if they were to say, I'd prefer you to have two facilities, but if we were to do one, Silver Creek Village is the one we should go with first.
The county council agreed to let Basin Rec return with a downsized proposal later this month. Councilmember Chris Robinson says it would be risky to put a large bond up for a vote and have it fail.
If it's like, you know, way out there and we serve something up that's dead on arrival, then people question our judgment. Why couldn't you read the tea leaves better? Why did you serve it up?
Councilmember Roger Armstrong says Parrish's data-driven approach has made for one of the best processes Armstrong has seen in his 13 years on council.
People throw around terms like transparency and you're not being transparent. You've been remarkably thorough with this, and your process is, when being part of the team that interviewed you, you know, a while back, it's kind of what set you aside among the candidates.
Parrish and the Basin Rec Board have a couple of weeks to revise their plans. State elections officials must know whether to put a bond on Snyderville Basin ballots 75 days before the November 3rd election. Summit County and Basin Rec are financial supporters of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
In the studio now with an update from the Summit County Health Department, I have Director Phil Bondurant. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Hey, just first, I mean, I know you're not the county communications department here, but do you have any idea what happened, what went wrong? Because first we got a get ready notice to evacuate Saturday night, and then yesterday afternoon, you know, the phones just started buzzing everywhere with us, telling us that we needed to go, that our residence was just within that evacuation area. I think that was mistakenly sent to a lot more people than it needed to go to.
Yeah, my understanding is that there was a glitch in the system that sent that out statewide. Now, I appreciate you prefacing this conversation. I am not an expert in this, nor am I intimately involved at this point, but I do know the situation is very dynamic. It's changing. You have a number of different professionals and experts working this situation with one common goal in mind, and that's to protect life, health, and safety. And when that happens, especially with something like this fire that has challenged traditional maybe systems, a glitch like that can be it can present itself. And so I know the county did a good job yesterday. KPCW did a wonderful job on social media helping correct that information. But I anticipate that they will have that solved here moving forward, given some of the unnecessary angst that created. But again, with everything going on, I think we are all human, and sometimes those mistakes happen. But as long as those mistakes don't happen and influence life, health, and safety, I think they're all made in the right frame of mind.
Okay, and I've got Summit County Manager Shane Scott, who could probably address it better.
Since absolutely,
it's under his jurisdiction. With school starting in a couple of weeks, of course, it's time for those back to school vaccinations. I know that there's a schedule of vaccinations that doctors know about.
Yeah, doctors, pediatricians, family practitioners. It's a state rule in the state of Utah that entering kindergarten, there's a series of vaccinations that children are required to have. And then when they get to grade 7 through 12, an additional series of vaccinations. A lot of times what we see happen is our kindergartners, those little ones that are venturing into their career in school, are well aware of what's taking place because they're seeing the pediatrician more often. They're getting their annual well checks. Pediatricians are having conversations with parents, and they're making decisions that are best for their families, for their children. as they enter that school system. Where we see a little bit of the gap is individuals going into seventh grade. Maybe those annual visits are not occurring annually, or they're not occurring at a time when it's close enough to the school year. And we see a few of the essential vaccines are missing going into seventh grade. And there's a rush. This is the week that rush occurs, the week before school, where parents and guardians are filling out paperwork, and there's that little box they have to check and some paperwork they need to provide. And there's that moment where their stomach flips upside down and they think, oh my goodness, I've forgotten something. And we get that. Again, we're all human. And we want to use this opportunity to remind individuals that that's okay at the health department. We have plenty of slots open. We have a few upcoming events at the different schools to help on back to school night and meet your teacher night, where we can get you caught up on those. You can call over to our main line at 435-333-1500. And our wonderful staff behind the phones can help you get caught up, get you an appointment, answer any questions that you have. But most importantly, just use this opportunity to realize that it's not too late. You can still get in. It can make it as easy as possible. And whether it's a kindergartner, a seventh grader, or a senior, we can set you on a path for a wonderful, healthy school year.
Okay. And again, is part of that seventh grade vaccination schedule another MMR? Prevent against measles?
It can be, depending on the series of what families and guardians work through with their pediatrician. Generally, it's Tdap, so tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis, meningococcal, and hepatitis B. But always, if you have any questions around whether or not your MMR is up to date, so that's measles, mumps, and rubella, is up to date, give us a call, 435-333-1500. Talk to your pediatrician. You can talk to your school nurses. They're a wonderful, trusted resource as well. You can call really any provider in town, and they can give you the rundown on what's going on. So we are focused on making sure people are aware of the risks and the decisions they make around measles, as it can have complications moving into the school year with that period where those that are unvaccinated and exposed would be removed from the school system for 21 days.
Okay. Last week, we suffered through more smoky skies from fires out of the north and northwest. What should listeners know about air quality, you know, and what they can do to protect themselves?
Yeah, I think the number one takeaway point from this conversation is that moving forward until we see some steady, significant moisture, the new norm is these smoky skies in and out throughout the afternoon and the day. And the reason for that is, quite honestly, we're surrounded by different fires that are of significant size and producing a lot of smoke, a lot of PM2.5 and a lot of PM10. And with that being the new norm, we need to adjust and modify the way that we spend our time outdoors. The health department still maintains a monitor, air quality monitoring network on our website. You can go there. You can check Purple Air. There's a number of different resources you can use, and all of them are reliable. And that's how we can determine how significant the impacts on our air are. We will be putting out notices through social media, through our website, to help people make those decisions. But really, if you have breathing complications like asthma, you have underlying health conditions, this is a really delicate and sensitive time for you. That smoke can really have an impact on you. And we want to make sure that individuals are taking proper precautions when they go outside. Look at those air monitors. Don't take off on a mountain bike ride that's extremely strenuous if the air quality is poor. Try to plan your visits out and about, whether you're running to the store to get groceries or running errands to the post office. Really be cognizant of what that air quality looks like and make those decisions. Now, we understand if this is the new norm, then there may not be periods where you can do that. And so be patient with yourself. Maybe take a good account of how you're feeling, what things look like, and plan accordingly, and don't overexert yourself outside. Right now we're praying for rain and hoping that things change climate-wise, not only for our air quality, but to help those firefighters and emergency responders get these under control across our state.
Yeah, so the concern about more exertive exercises because you're breathing deeper and bringing the particulate matter deeper into your lungs. Is that the problem here?
Yeah, absolutely. Think about, we all love sitting by the campfire, not this year. Please don't sit by the campfire this year. But under normal years around camping, when you sit on the fire and that fire circles around and you get a face full of smoke, it can be hard to breathe. It burns. It makes your throat sore. While it's not as significant or exaggerated as that example, it's the same idea. When you're working hard, you're breathing hard, you're taking in a lot more oxygen. And when that oxygen has a high concentration of particulate matter, it's going to impact your lungs.
Okay. And the PM 2.5 and 10, those just the different size of the particulate matter?
Yeah, great clarification. Particulate matter 2.5 is 2.5 microns. That's what we see in our emissions from vehicles. And PM 10, particulate matter size 10 microns, is what we would see from fires, forest fires, and the larger particulate matter.
Okay. Next month, the health department will start up some free cancer screening events. What do you have planned?
Yeah, I'm really excited about this. The staff has been doing a great job getting this put together. You know, we've talked about in the past skin cancer. Utah is among the highest, or actually it's the number one state for skin cancer in the United States. Summit County is number two in the number of rates. And so we're excited to offer some skin cancer screenings next month. And then mammograms, we fall as a state behind the national average and are ranked 44 out of 50 in the terms of mammogram screening rates. And recognizing these data and what they're telling us in some anecdotal conversations, we realize it's an access issue. It's a time issue. We're all short on time and heavy on things to do. And so September 30th, it's a little bit ways out, but we want people to plan for it. We have free cancer screening events over in the parking lot near the Park City Library. Now we're still working on the permitting process with our partners at Park City, but given our great relationship there and the history of this event, we're excited to offer those events, but also bring information around prostate screenings, how to schedule that, when you should be doing that, looking at lung cancer screenings and how we might be able to provide some reduced services there. So a lot of different things going on coming up related to cancer. And then the staff are still working on securing a few other opportunities for screenings, but we haven't been able to nail those down yet. And then when we move into October with Breast Cancer Awareness Month, we will have the breast cancer screening vans here in Summit County in a couple different locations throughout the month. So more information to come on that.
Okay, it'll be on your website once you get those dates finalized.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, and you're also planning to do, I wanted to ask though, I mean, when you talk about skin cancer, melanoma is just one part of skin cancer, just one type of skin cancer?
Yeah, it's one type of skin cancer. I'm not an oncologist, but it's the most prominent, and it's the, I don't want to say easiest, but it's maybe the simplest one to detect related to skin cancer, because a visual exam of the skin by a trained professional can identify areas that might be of concern or of melanomas. And in the past, we've reported where these events have been highly successful because they've extracted curious spots on the skin that ended up having cancerous tendencies. And that's what these events really do, is we recognize that not everyone has the time or the resources to go and do that. And if we are even pulling one sample away from an individual that was precancerous, then this event is highly successful. The good news is it's been more than one individual, it's been more than one sample, which is why we keep bringing these events back.
Okay. Health department also planning a seasonal drive-through vaccine clinic. When and where is this going to be?
Yeah, this is our third season of doing this. It's been another highly successful program, one that we're very proud of. We already have people asking about it. I attended Rotary a few weeks back, lunchtime Rotary, and we had people asking what the dates were, and that is Camas October 6th, Colville October 7th, and Park City October 8th. A really exciting event. We can get people through generally in between 10 to 15 minutes. We will have flu vaccines available for all ages. And we will also, we're anticipating having COVID available, but knowing that some of the things beyond our control at the federal level are dynamic and ever changing, we will be subject to those requirements or to those suggestions. So keeping an eye on that, if it's within our realm and in our authority, we definitely will have those COVID and other seasonal vaccines available. So mark your calendars. It's a great way to pop in wherever you're located geographically, have those seasonal vaccines done at a time when your immune system peaks and protects you when our trends tend to be the highest, and really just be able to enjoy that holiday season.
Is there a charge for the vaccines?
We do take insurance. There is a cash pay option. And then, of course, as I've mentioned multiple times, if for any reason there's someone cannot pay for the vaccine or does not have insurance, We will work with them. We have programs to make that happen. We don't ever want someone who wants to be vaccinated to protect themselves, to protect the community and their loved ones, to be turned away. So do not hesitate to attend one of these events. If you are interested in vaccination, our staff is creative. They have programs available and will get you what you need to protect you this fall.
Okay, any updates on the harmful algal blooms?
We've been talking about it all summer, and I anticipate traditionally and historically that we will see them this month in our areas here in Summit County and on the Wasatch Back. Right now, there's an ongoing surveillance system to make sure that we know exactly when that happens. But right now, all of our bodies of water are in good condition, no active harmful algal blooms. But when we talk about the heat and what we're experiencing right now with little bits of moisture popping up here and there, but really dry, hot days that warm up that top 6 feet of the water in those bodies of water, that's prime conditions for a harmful algal bloom. So although we do not have an active bloom right now in Summit County that we're aware of, we're just encouraging people, please take a visual assessment of the water. If it doesn't look healthy, move to a different part of the lake, report what you're seeing. We're happy to send people out. The state's happy to send people out to test so that we can make sure that we're keeping individuals and their families safe, and as well as their pets, as we know harmful algal blooms have a severe impact on our pets if they ingest or are exposed to that water.
All right. And then since last month, and we talked a little bit about bat activity, you're reporting a significant increase in people seeing bats, huh?
Yeah. In conversations with individuals at IHC, our epidemiologists, our nursing staff, we have seen this is a bit of an anomaly. The number of individuals, both residents and visitors, that have come into contact with bats over the last 30 days is quite honestly, it's just not something we've seen. A number of individuals have found themselves, because we could not capture the bat, they were exposed while they were out hiking or fishing or biking, have gone through the series of vaccinations to make sure that they don't develop rabies. We have not had a positive bat tested in Summit County, but we know neighboring counties have. And across the state, we've seen positives throughout the month of July. And there's a number of environmental factors that could be contributing to this. Nobody has a real understanding as to why, but it could be the heat. It could have been the mild winter, which allowed more bats to survive through and that cold spell and be available for activity this summer. But nonetheless, that increase is happening. And as we see these waning days of summer and we're trying to make the most out of every ounce of daylight we have, just be aware of bats. If you see bats flying around, leave the area. If you see a bat that appears to be dead or sick, please do not touch it. You can call the health department. We have trained people to come out and take that. We can get it down to the state lab to be tested. If you come into contact with a bat, as we talked about last month, do not smash it. Do not give in to your normal reaction to take care of that animal. Try to save it. Don't freeze it. We can get it to the lab and have it tested, which can save a lot of pain and anxiety associated with those shots that come along with it if we know the animal is negative for rabies. So just a quick reminder to people that bat activity is up. There are ways to protect yourself, but most importantly, if you are exposed, what you should do to protect yourself. And with any questions or exposures, call us again, 435-333-1500, and we have trained staff ready to talk you through that process.
All right, can they bite through a long sleeve shirt?
Generally, no. Where we see most of the exposures is when the bat lands on somebody and they scratch them, because they're constantly preening themselves and their feet or talons are constantly in their mouth. That's where the exposure occurs. So most of the time, if you've come into contact with a bat and that bat cannot be found or tested, we would encourage you to work with your primary care physician to determine the best course of action, which we treat every bat as though they might have rabies, and plan according to that, because we would hate to have some type of negative outcome associated with that for lack of action.
Yeah, do you have any numbers, though, on those that have been treated with rabies series?
I don't have the most current numbers. I will tell you that I spoke with an individual at Rotary last week and then with my epidemiologist this past week, and I was blown away that we've had double-digit numbers of people that have gone through prophylaxis, which is nothing like I've seen in my 14 years with the county. So not to say that we're in an, you know, that this is any type of emergency type situation. I think it's a unique year. There's a lot of things going on that are different with weather patterns and El Nino and fires and dry climate conditions and dry winters. So just protect yourself. It's more of just an awareness, letting people know what's going on rather than trying to cause alarm.
Okay. Anything else, Phil, you want to mention?
No, I think we're good. I appreciate the time.
All right. We'll see you next month. Thank you. That's Summit County Health Department Director Phil Bondurant. Well, Mountain Mediation offers professional mediation and communication services for residents across Summit and Wasatch counties. And in the studio with details on the center's family and divorce services, I have Director Gretchen Lee along with Associate Director Ned Droysch. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Leslie.
Gretchen, why don't we start with you? And just for listeners who may not be familiar with the Mountain Mediation Center, give us a little bit of background, what you do, and who you help.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for having us on. Mountain Mediation has been around as a local nonprofit for over 20 years now, and we help people prevent conflict, resolve disputes, and improve communication through our different programming, which is mediation. We have a robust eviction prevention program, and then our Let's Talk Communications trainings program.
Okay. And in terms of the cases that you see, I mean, could you generalize them? I mean, is it mostly evictions, mostly, you know, family services or?
No, you know what? We really see a variety of cases. I was looking at our case numbers before coming on this morning. And so far this year, we've mediated over 30 cases, really wide variety. Family, landlord, tenant, contract disputes, you name it, we've probably seen it. And in terms of the eviction prevention, we really like to take care of things before it gets to a mediation in terms of the education and keeping things upstream when at all possible.
All right, and why would somebody come see you before they just go to the courts?
Because we're less expensive, less time, and surveys have shown that the results are just more efficient and effective of if you can craft your own solutions to your own issues.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of unhappiness we know is because people insist on being right instead of happy, right? I mean, and how is it that you can help? I mean, do people need to be able to talk to one another in order to do mediation?
They really do. They do. I mean, we obviously can separate people out in rooms, and we do when they really can't talk to each other. At the beginning of any mediation, we assess the situation to see, okay, can we put these people in the same room together? And if not, we'll keep them separate, and we'll shuttle back and forth between the rooms. But if at all possible, we like to have them in the same room so they can begin to repair that relationship if it's possible.
All right. Well, Ned, let's talk a little bit about the role the center plays when families are going through some conflict or divorce. How does the center help?
Absolutely. We have a very also robust domestic program. We have four of the top state mediators in our program. And in addition to that, we have many other types of mediators who can come in and help with all sorts of family issues, everything from we've had cases where it's two family members who can't agree on where their child should go to school, all the way up into a very contentious divorce. We'd like to, again, like Gretchen said, do as much upstream possibilities as we can with them with our Let's Talk programming. Like, let's figure out a way that you guys can move forward in relation. But with our domestic program, you know, I think the basic is that divorce sucks. There's never a great divorce. We've had great divorces in the aspect that these two people are willing to sit in the same room. They're willing to work on their problems. But divorce is a very contentious and very, very unnerving time, especially when there's children involved. And with our divorce mediation programs, we really try to work with the top-end mediators who can work with all the different types of solutions for the children. Child calendaring is so difficult. Who gets to pick up the kids when they go to soccer practice, and how does the exchange look? And it can be all different types of issues, but the most important thing that we try to do at Mountain Mediation is when there is any type of place where we can find common ground, where we can get these two people in some sort of relation so they can work together, that's the most important thing moving forward. Yes, you can get a lawyer, you can fight it out in the court system, but in the end, you have to be in relation in some way. And that's what we as mediators try to improve, is how can we move you forward? It doesn't mean you're going to get back together. It just means how do we get you two to be good parents. How do we get you to be good citizens in our society? Small Park City, Wasatch County, we are small. You're going to see each other again. We want to make sure that we can have a place where you both can reside in the same community together. And just maybe it's just a hello down the street or, again, having a great exchange. And we always want to keep those parents working together as great parents.
Yeah. So I guess what does it offer families that litigation may not?
So really it goes back to what Gretchen was saying about having you either in the same room or it's crafting your own solutions. So when you go through the litigation process, you're given a lot of kind of rules. They're called statutes where they say like, okay, you can do this at 50%, 60-40. What do the days look like? But that may not work for your family. We've dealt with situations where one parent travels a lot. So if you're saying every other weekend, that doesn't work for that family. But the courts might say that's what it's going to be. So that really puts that person's job on the line. So we want to work in a mediation where what does it work for you? What looks right for you and your family?
All right. And so when you do have somebody and come to some sort of agreement, then it goes to the court? Because you got to have some kind of decree, right?
Absolutely. Great question, Leslie. So with the mediation programming, what you can do is you come into mediation and we work on all the different, we call it a checklist, whether it's alimony, child support, retirement accounts and things of that nature. And then after that, you can work with a paralegal, or we have some different organizations we work with that can then go and do the kind of the legal write-up. Then that gets sent to the commissioner. Commissioner signs off on it. And so that's probably the most legal piece of it. And there is some, you do have to actually file through the court system, and we can, you know, help with the, how do you file for the case, where that is in my, it's called My Case. And really what it is if we can get that agreement done without all of that court case stuff, then it's just a lot smoother. But we do understand that sometimes we do have parties who do bring lawyers in, and that's great too. We can mediate with lawyers, and that sometimes gives people a little bit more of a comfort level. They're feeling like there is a legal piece to it, but it's not necessary.
So are mediators lawyers?
Great question. A lot of mediators are, but when they are mediators, they are neutral parties. They are not acting on behalf as an attorney. But being a domestic mediator, which I am one, and it means that I had to go through my regular mediation training, and then I had to go through extra training to do the domestic piece of that, meaning a lot more legalese kind of stuff just to make sure that I'm following the statutes that our state requires.
All right, so you don't have the JD behind you?
I do not have the JD.
Okay, but very well trained.
I believe so.
you mentioned, you know, that it's cheaper than going through a legal system, but it still costs money. Yeah, how much?
Absolutely. So there's state filings around about $300, and that's just what you have to do for the state. That we don't have any part in that. But we offer mediation services at $160 an hour. That's full price for us. But we also offer it on a sliding scale, depending upon need. So we have a lot of programs for those who, you know, don't make as much money. And a going rate for a mediator in Park City or Wasatch County is around $300 to $400 an hour. So us at $160, we are not only a bargain, and I don't like to use the word bargain, because we again use the most highly qualified mediators.
So why can you do it less expensively?
Thank you for asking that. We work with a lot of mediators who help give of their services to us. And then we do a lot of fundraising. We actually have a fundraiser coming up here on September 10th at the Pendry Pool House. It's going to be a lot of fun. We'd love to have as many people who can come and sponsors that want to come in. But that's how we're able to do that. We do a lot of fundraising, and then some of the mediators that we work with donate their services back.
Okay. Can you tell us what kind of demand you're seeing right now for your family services?
Absolutely. Not all of our services end up in a what we call a mediation situation. A lot of our stuff is upstream. So they're coming to us and they're just looking for some help. We do consults. So we're probably getting around 10 intakes a month where they're just coming to us and saying, I don't really know what's going on. I don't know what my next steps are. And they're in a... it's really a crisis for them at that moment. So sometimes the first step is, let's just talk. Where are you at? What are you looking for? Let us tell you what the process is. We also offer something called a divorce options workshop. We do it about every 2 to 3 months. We have one coming up on September 12th, and it is free. We do ask people to register because we send out a private Zoom link, and that helps protect people if they're feeling nervous about their current situation. But you know, not all of ours end up in mediation. A lot of what we want to do is we want to offer that listening ear, that moment of like, where are you at? How can we help? And if it's not with us, we will get you to the place you need to be.
Okay, how can people find out more about that divorce workshop?
They can go to our website. Our website is pretty long, but it's mountainmediationcenter.org, and that's not mountain meditation. A lot of people mistype it. It's mountainmediationcenter.org, and you know, there's a calendar of events, and you can find all of our registrations for all of our different programs there.
Okay, is that something that you would run? I mean, people just come with questions? That's how it
works. Absolutely. Yeah. We actually partner with a program down in, it was a statewide program. It's the Association for...
Utah Collaborative.
Utah Collaborative, thank you so much. They're fantastic. And then we walk through all the different options of divorce, that kind of all the different paths that you can look at.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit more about that fundraiser. It says Voices in Harmony, as you mentioned, September 10th, 6 p.m. at the Pendry Pool House. What kind of happens here? People buy a ticket?
They buy a ticket. We have some, you know, we have the silent auction. We've got a live auction. We've got an amazing wine pool. We have the amazing... fingers of Paul Hochman. He's going to be doing a really cool show. We're going to be working on how do you actually come in as Voices in Harmony. What does it sound like when, you know, I'm not a singer, but like when you're off key, but what does it sound like when we all come in harmony? And Paul's going to be bringing us all together and showing us what it means when we actually can sound like we're in harmony.
Okay. And then with the money that you raise through the fundraiser, it just allows you to do
more of what we do, offer up our mediations on a sliding scale. Like, we'd love to offer up as many programs and services as we can. We have a Let's Talk program coming up, Let's Talk Essentials at, it's going to be on September 24th at St. Luke's Episcopal Church.
Okay, tell me a little bit more about that Let's Talk. Again, that was a Leadership Park City project that you kind of took over.
Yeah, so the Let's Talk Essentials is kind of what we call our level one, but it's the most important part of, like, where do we come from when we're entering into a conversation? What are the biases that you're bringing in? How are you feeling? Have you slept very much? You know, all those different types of things that come into that. And then we also have a suite of programs after that. So we try to get the Let's Talk Essentials out to as many people in our service areas possible for free. We actually just got a fantastic grant from the Sunrise Rotary to help us give a couple more of those. So we want to be able to give Let's Talk Essentials across our service area for free at any time. Doesn't always happen, but and then we have a suite of programs dealing with difficult conversations and building trust through communication. Those are some of more of our Let's Talk levels, and we offer those to businesses and programs at fees. Again, much less than most other people, but again, our goal is to bring our communication programming out to as many people as possible, that when they have that conflict, they can kind of go back in their brain and say, oh, I remember this. I'm actually kind of entering into this situation tired or angry or biased, or what is it that I'm coming into that I can watch how my words are coming out?
Okay. And then the grant that you received from the Women's Giving Fund a few years ago, that was spent for, I think, your eviction program?
Well, actually, it was eviction program and our domestic mediation program. And that the grant really allowed us to get our eviction program up and off the ground. Of this year, we were so excited. We received the Utah Housing Coalition's Stability Award. So we received statewide recognition for the award. And again, so much is that the emphasis is on the upstream education prevention piece, because it's tough to find landlords and tenants downstream in conflict around that 3-day pay or vacate notice time.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
Just learn to communicate, everyone.
Okay. All right. Ned Joyce, Gretchen Lee from Mountain Mediation Center. Thanks so much for your time.
Great. Thanks.
Well, after a record low snowfall and record-breaking summer of hot temperatures and low rainfall, how is Park City's system holding up? Well, in the studio, we've got Park City Public Utilities Director Clint McAfee along with Water Quality Manager Michelle DeHong. Good morning.
Good morning.
Clint, so after a very low snow year followed by this hot and exceptionally dry summer, how is the city's water supply holding up right now?
You know, it's surprisingly well. You know, as you mentioned, we did have record low snowpack last year. And just a reminder, precipitation-wise, we were actually pretty average, but it just fell in the form of rain. We were helped by high soil moisture conditions kind of going into the winter and coming out of the winter, and higher reservoir levels. But it's been very hot, very dry this summer. Those rains recently have helped out. But the city really has invested in a diverse and robust water source portfolio. We primarily rely on groundwater. We're at the top of the watershed, so we don't really have a river or large storage reservoirs above us. And so our groundwater sources include two abandoned mine tunnels, three wells, a spring. And then to supplement those local groundwater sources, we import water from other watersheds, from the Rockport Reservoir and the Provo River drainage, the water draining out of the Ontario Drain Tunnel. We capture that before it goes into Rockport Reservoir and import that. That supplements our local water supply. And we try to maintain enough water supply to meet our peak day demand, which usually occurs in the summertime. Due to outdoor irrigation, and maintain enough redundancy in case we lose a source or two.
Yeah, I mean, how much water are you able to store? Just the 500,000 gallons there?
No, so we, not that, it'll sound like a lot, but it's really not. So we have about right around 15 million gallons of storage in the system. That's treated water that is ready for to serve to the public. And those are located, we have about 18 water tanks located around the city. And what that does is really provide enough storage to kind of augment those peak times, usually occurring in the morning when people are irrigating, and then the tank levels drop during the day, and then we start to fill them back up in the afternoon and throughout the night, ready for the next morning. And then in addition to that, we like to keep enough for a few hours of emergency storage and fire flow. And so if there's a structure fire, you know, we have that storage in those tanks reserved for fighting a fire, for, you know, and there's different areas of town that require different volumes, but up to 500,000 gallons of fire flow storage on top of the peak day and emergency storage.
Okay, so what is the peak capacity? I mean, how much water can you manufacture, or, you know, have on any given day?
Sure, yeah. So we look at our reliable yield. So that number depends on, you know, how much snowpack we've had. But the reliable dry year yield of our water sources is about 14 million gallons per day. And our potable peak day demand this year, believe it or not, is actually lower than last year. It occurred on June 24th, and it was 7.75 million gallons per day of treated water. So that includes the water we're serving to our own customers, plus the water we're providing through the interconnect to Weber Basin to Summit Water. And then in addition to that, we provide water to the municipal golf course and the country Park Meadows Country Club golf course. So that's another 2 million gallons a day on top of that. And then we have stream flow obligations in McLeod Creek, and that's where the balance of that water goes.
Okay, so I mean, is it are we using everything that we're pulling from the sources?
We only divert what we need to, you know, we divert to meet our demands. The rest goes downstream. Obviously, if we, you know, don't pump out of a well, it's not going down the stream.
Yeah.
But it stays in the underground water storage.
So with the lack of snowpack and ongoing drought conditions, is it affecting our groundwater sources? And if so, by how much?
It will, and it has, for sure. You know, we primarily rely on snowpack to recharge our groundwater aquifers. Rain tends to run off quickly or is evaporated or taken up by plants and you know, transpired into the air that way. Where snowpack really sits on that on the ground, melts and recharges in a more substantial way, and so they, you know, with this low snowpack, that definitely impacts the levels and the amount of water being stored. We can absorb a few years like last year and still meet demands, but you know, if we get another low snowpack year this coming winter, I think you'll see us come out with some more heavy messaging at minimum and likely restrictions for next year if the snowpack is as bad as we had last year.
Okay, because that was going to be my next question, so we're keeping our eye on that.
Yeah, I mean, if we have an average snowpack, I wouldn't anticipate anything. You know, like I said, we're actually lower. Our peak day demand was lower this year as a community. Last year, on August 8th, we served up 8.4 million gallons on our peak day. This year, on June 24th, it was 7.75 million gallons. And again, that includes increased supply to the Snyderville Basin area. So, you know, I think this community is doing a great job conserving. There's still plenty of room for improvement if we need to go that way with snowpack conditions. You know, and put it in perspective, like our winter demand is about 2.5 to 3 million gallons per day. So right now, even in the summertime, we're probably serving close to 8 million gallons a day. Only 3 of that is indoor, the rest is outdoor.
Okay. Only 3 million during the winter, and that's all snowmaking?
So that's just indoor use. Okay. So commercial, restaurants, hotels, you know, in your house, your shower, your kitchen, all the indoor use that returns to the creek, you know, after it's treated by the sewer district. And on top of that, when Deer Valley and Vail are pulling water for snowmaking, we actually reach our summer peak day demands, if not higher. We're probably closer to 9 million gallons a day in the winter time. But that demand is easier to control because it's two customers, and if we get in a bind, they're great partners. We can call them and say, "Hey, we've got an issue here. We need to cut back a little bit." Summertime, not so much. We've got 6,000 customers that, you know, you really can't reach.
Okay, Michelle, from a water quality perspective, have you seen any changes in the city's wells or groundwater supplies as a result of the drought and hot summer?
Yeah, good question, Leslie. You know, one of the things that we look at is things like water levels, right? And we haven't had any changes in the well water levels. We're certainly seeing a little bit less yield from the tunnels and the springs this year. But, you know, to Clint's point, those are usually longer term sources that are impacted, you know, over a couple of years of different issues. Well, from a water quality perspective, we don't see any difference relating to drought conditions. We've been really working hard this year with the public to talk more about just the quality of the water and just sharing with them the work it takes to treat high quality drinking water.
Yeah, so with less yield though, I mean, do you see higher mineral concentrations in the
water?
No,
we really haven't. The aquifers are, you know, continuing to be replenished each year, and we don't see any real change there. We generally see, you know, higher total dissolved solids and things like that in the spring when we have runoff from heavy snow years and having to deal with road salts. But this last winter, you know, we didn't even have as much of that, those types of interactions from a water quality perspective.
Yeah. How frequently are the city's wells and other sources tested?
We're actually doing water quality testing every single day, 24/7. We have remote monitoring in the water distribution system that our scientists and operators monitor continuously. And at all of our water treatment plants, we test daily and in the water distribution system.
Okay, so Park City's wells haven't experienced any contamination or water quality problems this summer. Yeah, well, that's good news. And I guess, you know, I think that's probably the biggest point, Clint, is when you mentioned, you know, for residents who hear about the low snowpack and drought and, of course, the fire risk. Mm-hmm. Could Park City run out of water if we needed to fight a fire?
You know, our system really isn't designed to fight like a wildland fire. Actually, by regulation, we're required to maintain enough storage to fight structure fires. We will help as much as we can if we have a local event, wildfire event, but our system is really not set up for the high volume, you know, and it's also static, right? You can't move a fire hydrant to where the fire is, and we have flow rate restrictions. So again, we will help as much as we possibly can with whatever event occurs. There's not really a drinking water system that is producing drinking water that is really capable of helping there.
Okay, and then what are you watching over the next several months that tell you whether or not Park City's headed into a more serious water supply situation, you know, next year?
Oh, man. I don't know. Maybe our crystal ball, you tell us. I think I read KPCW had an recent article about the El Nino conditions, which might bring some wetter conditions. The Farmer's Almanac is saying, you know, wetter. But I think until we get there, I mean, it's good to pay attention to that stuff, but we're prepared for the worst, and that's what we really focus on.
Okay. That's about all the time I got for anything quickly that you wanted to mention?
Just very quickly, we have a couple projects starting, one up in Pinnacle Subdivision in Lower Deer Valley, and we will be replacing the water line there and along Deer Valley Drive from the Y up to Doe Pass in the Lower Deer Valley area. And we're also looking at a water rate study. So we're selecting a consultant now. We expect to take that to council on September 3rd. And they're going to take a comprehensive look at how we charge our customers, make sure it's fair, equitable, and reflects council's policies. And we'll start that process with a council work session so they can really weigh in and help shape the water rates.
Okay, great. Clint McAfee, Michelle DeHaan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.